This problem is a lot bigger than official statistics or reports lead us to believe. And I want to put forward the caveat that our database, although it's a lot larger than any other one that I'm aware of, is based entirely on reported cases, except for, you know, the snowball effect where we might locate cases here or there that haven't been reported by a family member. But for the most part, the majority of our data set is based on family and community members reporting missing and murdered individuals. And so that means that there are so many other people that aren't included in our data set who were never officially reported missing or murdered.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Vandal Theory, a podcast about science and research at the University of Idaho. My name's Lee Cooper, and I'm a science writer and editor here at University of Idaho. And I'm here with my co-host, Kyle.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kyle Fonensteel, Media Relations Manager here at U of I.
Hey, Kyle. How's it going?
Good. How about you?
Oh, not too bad. Happy that it's Friday and ready for a weekend.
Me too.
All right. Well, today we have a pretty serious subject matter. We're talking about missing and murdered indigenous populations in the U.S. and Canada. And my question to have us start in on this is, for these complex social problems, the missing and murdered indigenous populations, things like gun violence, how to distribute healthcare across our nations, all of those are incredibly complex social problems. How do we even start to deal with those types of issues?
That is a lot to process, but I guess I might lean on some lessons we learned earlier this season in episode 4, where we talked to two researchers who were modeling public health data in Idaho at a scale that they think will give policymakers more information to be able to make targeted decisions to help people. What I learned from them is that you have to actually know what the problem is. And to know what the problem is, you have to measure whatever variables you know at the appropriate scale. So these two researchers talked to us about their work together to model public health data on a smaller scale from Idaho, zooming in from the public health district level, which is pretty large and spans several counties, down to the county level, which might feel more like a community to some. Their work is all about finding more local patterns to health trends in Idaho to guide how aid money and resources are allocated. So I guess I'd have to say, you have to know that you're looking in the right places and that you're measuring the right things.
Yeah, I agree. It comes down to, you don't know what you're solving if you don't know exactly what the problem is. And not to say that we don't know that, in this case, missing and murdered Indigenous people, and especially women, exist. Like, we know that's a problem, but quantifying it becomes so important. And that's what Omi Hodwitz is trying to do. Omi is an associate professor in the Department of Culture, Society, and Justice at University of Idaho. She and her students are compiling the most comprehensive database to date of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirits in Canada and the United States. All right, ready to do this one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Omi, hello, welcome to The Vandal Theory.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
Oh, glad to have you on. Can you introduce yourself to everyone?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. My name is Omi Hodwitz. I'm a criminologist and associate professor at the Department of Culture, Society, and Justice here at UI.
All right, excellent. So you've taken up a new area of research. What is the problem that you're working on right now?
Yeah, this is a big one. Specifically, I am looking at missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirits in the United States and Canada. And so we're aware as researchers, as academics, as policymakers, as practitioners, that this is a fairly substantial problem in the United States and Canada. But we don't know the extent of the problem due to missing data, gaps in the databases that we do have, and databases that aren't accessible to the general public. So I'm looking at kind of exploring this particular issue and seeking to fill those gaps in the data.
How did you get involved with putting this information together?
I'm actually a Canadian by birth. I was raised in the temperate rainforest of British Columbia. And as I grew up in an activist family, and we worked very closely with Indigenous communities along the coast, the west coast of Canada in the British Columbia area. I actually, over a decade, worked with a variety of different non-governmental organizations, including Greenpeace and the Forest Action Network and the Rainforest Action Network, and spent several years living with Indigenous communities, the Nechelnith and the Newhawk and the Haida, working with them directly on land rights various issues, fishery issues and things of that sort. The time that I spent with them, I mean, there was a lot of awareness and concern within these communities about missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit. And a kind of constant theme or narrative was the recognition that governments and practitioners were not fully aware of the issue. So I've kind of been involved in this more in an activist sense than an academic sense for most of my life.
And before we go any further, can you define Two-Spirit?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Western definitions tend to equate Two-Spirit to transgender identity, and that's actually not exactly accurate. Two-Spirit are individuals within select Indigenous communities in North America who identify with both genders. So gender is not necessarily a binary construct in these communities. And these individuals are bestowed with qualities of what we would traditionally call male and female identity.
Okay. So specifically, what is your team doing?
We're building a database. And this is an aggregate database of all reported cases of missing and murdered individuals, Indigenous individuals in the United States and Canada. So it's called the MMIWG2, recognizing that in particular, Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit experience high rates of victimization in both countries. But we also do include male identifying individuals in the database to better understand that issue and also use it as a point of comparison. It's a very large database at this point. So we identify reported incidents of MMIW, G2s and male identifying individuals. And then we kind of methodically go through and verify each case that it's a legitimate case that meets our inclusion criteria. We examine the details of the case and encode those details. We look at law enforcement response. We look at case resolution, if there is a case resolution, and that kind of activity.
So obviously, I mean, we have 50 states here. We have different territories. We have tribes. We have counties. We have lots of ways of places maybe that would keep or not keep records of this sort. How do you start building this database?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. There is, as you noted, a fair number of sources of data spread across both countries, piecemeal bits of data, and a lot of it is not publicly accessible to academics or to the community at large. And many of these data sources have been criticized for basically lowballing the reality or providing inaccurate and lowballed estimates of the extent of this problem. In response to that, there are a number of Indigenous communities who have created their own open source databases and put a call out to Indigenous communities across, you know, in their region or across the country, inviting those communities to report directly to those databases any incidents of missing and murdered loved ones of Indigenous background. That's where we started. Those are open access. They're public source, so we have access to them. And they tend to include a lot of cases that may not be recognized by the state or by law enforcement, by various practitioners or things of that sort. So we gathered together all of the community databases that we could find. And there's a number of them out there, and they are fairly exhaustive. And we use that to create our baseline, and comparing the different databases, making a different case for each individual that was included in each one, removing the duplicates. And we saw a fair amount of overlap, actually a great amount of overlap between these community source databases. So that was actually a good sign that they were relatively exhaustive in their scope.
Has it been, I don't know, kind of just a slow plodding forward of gathering these? Or, you know, does one person say, oh, hey, I heard you talked to so-and-so and hey, we have a database too. Any sort of snowballing effects?
Yes, our data collection efforts were definitely a snowball process. So once we had identified all of the potential reported incidents in or individuals in each of these databases and put them in kind of a central hub, we started going down the rabbit hole. So we would look at an individual case and then find, you know, maybe a family member had reported a daughter who was missing. And so we would look at that individual's case and find that that individual was actually in a group of three or four that went missing. And those people hadn't been identified yet. So it really was a snowball effect, as you said it, identifying a starting point and then finding almost a network of other impacted individuals who hadn't been included in that database. So we spent months kind of mapping out this organic network. It was definitely unsettling work. I'm not going to pretend as though it wasn't. But at a certain point, those networks started to overlap so much that we started to gain some sense of confidence that although we certainly hadn't identified everybody out there, that we had started to at least gain a foothold on understanding the extent of the problem at, you know, more so than other databases had done.
You talked about, obviously, you're looking at the facts of the case and whether there was a closure. Any other types of data that you were kind of looking for?
Yeah, so the database actually consists of 50 some odd variables other than, you know, some more just kind of administrative variables like case numbers and things of that sort. We include demographic information of the individual, gender identity, region, location, familial relationships between different cases that are included in our data set, who reported the case. We think that's really important to see if the report is coming from members of an indigenous community, what's the response like from law enforcement versus if it's coming from, for example, a non-governmental organization or something along those lines. And then, of course, we look at law enforcement responses, perpetrator, if there is a perpetrator and that perpetrator is known, and the characteristics of that individual, and then a variety of case closure variables, everything from in the cases of the taking of a life, whether or not a body has been found, you know, was a perpetrator actually convicted? And then a few qualitative variables as well, you know, family testimonials about law enforcement response and things of that nature.
Yeah, I can see that making for long days, intense days. So I realize you're still compiling and still putting all the data in, but what questions will you hopefully be able to address once the database is complete?
So this is, I mean, there are a number of things we can do with this database. At the most basic level, and this really is the driving motivation, is to start to understand the extent of the problem. At this point, we have 6,000 cases spread across both countries, and we've only verified and coded a small portion of that, about a third of that at this point. So we still have a lot of work to do. But for the most part, through that verification process, we're eliminating very few cases. So at the end of this, we may have more than 6,000, we may have less. But where it currently stands, if we look at the cases that we have verified and the ones that we still have yet to verify, they are in the thousands. And when you compare that to federal numbers, state numbers coming from both Canada and the United States, for the most part, national numbers or federal numbers are quoting statistics that are in the hundreds. That's very clear, or a fairly clear confirmation of what we originally suspected, and which is part of our understanding of this particular issue, which is the problem is a lot bigger than official statistics lead us to believe. we want to focus on that first and foremost.
First off, if those numbers are, like you said, even in the ballpark, that's extraordinary. When you're saying the federal government is looking at hundreds, you're looking at thousands, is that over, what kind of time period is that over?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So it depends on which country we're talking about, and also depends on whether or not we're talking about state, provincial, territorial metrics. Our database covers a 40-year period at this point. We still have to add 2021. Our database stops at 2020 right now. So it goes from 1980 through to 2020. Right now, the first two decades are very sparse. So we're looking back in time. And of course, you know, it's difficult to dig up historical records from 40 years ago, you know, before the internet was so commonplace and before these community databases were set up. So if we're just talking about the past 10 years, that's where the majority of our cases are coming from. Out of the 6,000, I would say at least 5,000 are coming from the last 10 years. And so when I'm citing those numbers, I'm talking specifically estimates over a decade.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's helpful to just, I think, put it in context. But yeah, let's return to the previous questions of what other questions will the database help you tackle?
So in addition to just starting to understand the extent of the problem and also providing a point of comparison between official statistics and the statistics that we're able to identify with our data set, we'll also be able to look at law enforcement response. So for example, in the United States, and it's a little bit different in Canada, but in the United States, depending on the location of the incident, the tribal police might take lead on any reported missing or murdered Indigenous folks versus the state police or federal police. We can do those kinds of comparisons to see which form of law enforcement response is more effective or better able to identify a perpetrator, or if they do identify a perpetrator, to bring that individual to justice. We can also look at the effects of policies. So once again, it's different between Canada and the United States, but one big policy that was implemented a few years ago was Operation Lady Justice, and that was implemented by the Trump administration. It purports to do a number of things, including revealing the extent of the problem and starting to kind of mitigate some of the factors that might facilitate missing and murdered Indigenous folks. But we don't have the data to actually test whether or not a policy such as Operation Lady Justice is doing what it purports to do. So our database will allow us to actually examine that a little bit more carefully using the data to tell us the story behind the effectiveness of those types of policies.
So as you said, you have a little bit to go finishing with the database, but are you seeing even now some hints of trends emerging?
Yeah, definitely. Although, as you noted, I will caution that it's too early to say with any certainty that what we are starting to see is actually, you know, reflective of reality. Because at this point, we're coding the data in alphabetical order based on the individual's last name. We're not sticking to particular regions or one country over the other. So that kind of curbs our ability to say, oh, we have, for example, all of Idaho cases coded, and this is what's happening in Idaho. We're approaching it in a different way. But from what we are seeing, it does seem that, for example, tribal police do appear to be more effective at identifying perpetrators when there is an incident that involves a perpetrator, and more effective at actually bringing those cases to a close. It also seems that male identifying victims are more likely to result in case resolution as well, which is an interesting one. And then, of course, as I've already alluded to, you know, at this early stage in the game, the real takeaway is that our official statistics really do not reflect the extent of the problem.
So where do you go from here? What's the next steps?
It's a good question. Well, we need to finish coding. We need to finish identifying cases, those, you know, any additional cases that we haven't located so far, which is, of course, part of the coding process. At this point, we've pretty much exhaustively gutted all the databases that we have access to. And so now it's just a matter of coding and then identifying cases that we've missed as we code. That's going to take a little bit of time still. It took us 4 months with several coders on staff working full time, you know, 40 hours a week to get that first third of the data set finished. And we don't want to rush it. This is slow, methodical, and very careful work that we're doing out of respect for the individuals that we're examining, and also for the sake of ensuring that we are producing quality data. So we expect that it'll take probably another 2 years before we've completed the data that we currently have and have updated the data to include 2021 and potentially 2022. And by the time we get to the end of that, we are going to have to go back and check every single case again. This is a dynamic data set. These are individuals whose cases continue past the point that we finish coding them. So we will have to every year go back and check on the status of these cases to see if they've been resolved, to add new cases that have come up, you know, since the last time we had coded. So that's kind of our long-term vision.
Sounds good. Well, we're getting on towards the end here. If people kind of walk away with remembering one thing, what would you want them to remember about this?
I've mentioned this a few times, but I really want to emphasize it. This problem is a lot bigger than official statistics or reports lead us to believe. And I want to put forward the caveat that our database, although it's a lot larger than any other one that I'm aware of, is based entirely on reported cases, except for, you know, the snowball effect where we might locate cases here or there that haven't been reported by a family member. But for the most part, the majority of our data set is based on family and community members reporting missing and murdered individuals. And so that means that there are so many other people that aren't included in our data set who were never officially reported missing or murdered. Our data is illustrating that what we know about this problem based on official statistics is very little at this point. And there's a lot more that we could learn. But even then, our database should be taken with a grain of salt, a pretty serious grain of salt, because our database is also flawed in the sense that somebody must be reported in order for us to include it in our database.
All right. Well, Omi, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Kyle, so I know there was a lot. What do you think?
I guess the first thing that struck me is how much potential there is in this work. I think I've heard you say it before. We don't know what we don't know. Omi's projection being in the thousands, while the federal government is in the hundreds, really shows that there's a disconnect between what communities are experiencing and seeing and what officials are measuring. It sounds like Omi's work will be really critical to help close that gap. In a lot of ways, this reminds me of some work that some influential journalists have done, some journalists at the Washington Post who they started a project a while back tracking school shootings in depth across the U.S., something that the federal government wasn't doing as well. Once they had the database built, they highlighted incredible things that cut through some of our assumptions about school shootings and help really put the problem in scale. There's something about communicating the scale of these problems that's really important part of helping us understand what's happening in our communities. It's this mix between getting the problems in scale through data at this and also reading firsthand experiences. But when this work is combined, it's especially powerful.
These databases, whether, you know, this one that Omi is putting together or things like the school shooting database, the necessity of them can't really be put into words. And it's odd the kind of oppositional dichotomy that comes with them, because without it being shown as numbers, to know that there's thousands and not hundreds of these missing and murdered people, we can't understand the scale of the problem. But by reducing it to numbers, you forget that, not forget necessarily, but it becomes secondary that these are real people and that each of these numbers represent a person lost, a family torn apart, a community that's been affected. And realizing that each one of these numbers is a story and a human. And that somehow together, the quantifying of these numbers and the stories need to go together, and hopefully we'll start to make a difference. All right, everyone. Thank you for listening to The Vandal Theory. You can visit our website, uidaho.edu/vandaltheory, for more about our research. You can also email us at vandaltheory@uidaho.edu. We're on most of the platforms out there for podcasting, so please go and rate and review us, and we'd love it if you'd subscribe. My name is Lee Cooper.
And I'm Kyle Fawnensteel.
Thanks, everyone, for listening.